nuclear reactors, no technique for building one, no scientist who was sure a chain reaction could be created. In the whole country, there were not 40 pounds of uranium suitable for experiments. There was no setup for producing ordinary uranium in quantity, let alone the very rare isotope 235 that might blow up. And for all the meetings of the Uranium Committee and the whisperings among scientists, the government had not yet spent on this project $100,000 in cash. Kirby estimated that by now the Germans, in their massive try for world empire, might have already spent, in the same effort, something like $1 billion. The Uranium Committee sat in a drab seminar room, warm and smoky despite the open windows and the continuing thunderstorm outside. Elementary equations from an undergraduate course were chalked on the small, dusty blackboard. Kirby knew everybody who sat around the table, except for two uniformed military visitors, an Army colonel and a Navy captain. The scientists were in shirt sleeves, some with ties off and sleeves rolled up. Lyman Briggs, director of the National Bureau of Standards, was still chairman, and this further depressed Kirby. Briggs was a pleasant, gray-haired bureau head to whom $1,000 was a spectacular federal expenditure. He wore his coat and tie. Dr. Lawrence gave Kirby a friendly wave and turned to the military men sitting beside him. "This is Dr. Kirby, president of Denver Electric Works, Colonel Thomas, and Captain Kelleher." Kirby passed out copies of a mimeographed document and read the paper aloud, sometimes pausing for thunder crashes. The committee listened with narrow-eyed attention, all but Captain Kelleher, a bald chain-smoker with a big double chin, who stared straight ahead in a slump, now and then scratching through his blue and gold uniform at one place on his chest. The Army colonel, a studious-looking small man with a bad cough, kept eating lozenges from a paper box, while he made shorthand notes on the margins of Kirby's paper. Kirby was replying to questions posed to him by Lawrence in the letter. Could he manufacture these giant electric magnets? And if so, what would be the probable costs and production time? Lawrence's idea, which he was pushing with the peculiar force and single-mindedness that made him loved or hated by other scientists, was to produce uranium-235 by separating a stream of ionized molecules of uranium in a magnetic field, a method Kirby had once described to Victor Henry. There already existed a laboratory tool, the mass spectrograph, that worked this way. Lawrence wanted to make giant mass spectrographs to get uranium-235 in sufficient quantities for war use. Nothing like it had ever been done. The whole notion required, among other things, monster electromagnets which would keep an unwavering field. The slightest voltage change would wash out the infinitesimal difference in the molecule paths of U-238 and U-235, on which the whole idea hung. When Kirby named a feasible date for delivering the first magnets and the range of prices he would charge, the committee men started glancing at each other. He finished with a warning about supply problems requiring high priorities and sat down. Lawrence was beaming at him through his round glasses. "Well, that's encouraging," Lyman Briggs said mildly, fingering his tie. "Of course, the price figures are still in the realm of pure fantasy." The Navy captain put in, "Dr. Kirby, we've had fellows from General Electric and Westinghouse report on this. They project twice as much time, more than twice as much money, and they shade those performance characteristics considerably." Palmer Kirby shrugged. "Could well be."
"Why should we take your word on feasibility against theirs?" Colonel Thomas said hoarsely, shaking a lozenge out of his box.
Kirby said, "Colonel, I once worked at Westinghouse. They make everything that uses an electric current. I make custom-designed equipment, and I specialize in electromagnets. It's a narrow specialty, but it's mine. The Germans were way ahead of us at one point. I went to Germany. I studied their components and imported their nickel alloy cores. Westinghouse and General Electric don't know that area of technology as I do. They don't have to. For special jobs in electromagnets, I can outperform them. At least I'm claiming that I can, and I'm prepared to bid in these terms." When Palmer Kirby mentioned Germany, the glances went again around the table. The Navy captain spoke up in a peevish voice.
"Are the Germans still ahead of us?"
"On what, sir?"
"On anything. On making these bombs to get down to the short hairs."
Kirby puffed at his pipe.
"Well, the self-confidence they've just showed isn't encouraging."
"I agree. Well, why don't we get going, then? All this committee seems to do is palaver."
Kelleher sat up straight, glowering.
"I'm not a scientist, and I can't say I've taken much stock in these futuristic weapons, but by Christ, if there's anything in them, let's get cracking. Let's go straight to the President and howl for money and action. I can assure you the Navy will back the committee."
Holding up a thin hand in dismay, Briggs said, "The President has more immediate things, Captain, requiring money and action."
"I don't agree," Thomas said. "More immediate than these bombs?"
Briggs retorted, "It's all pure theory, Colonel, years away from any possible practical result." Captain Kelleher slapped his hand on the table.
"Look, let me ask a real dumb question. What's Kirby talking about here? Is it the diffusion business or the spectrograph business? Maybe I ought to know, but I don't."
"The spectrograph business," Lawrence said in a fatherly tone.
"All right. Then why don't you just shoot the works on that? You've got a Nobel Prize. Why don't you send the President a red-hot, plain-language memo that he can grasp? Why do you keep fudging around on these other approaches?"
"Because if we guess wrong on the basic approach," another scientist mildly observed, "we may lose several years." Kirby could not resist saying,
"Or lose the whole race to the Germans."
The discussion halted. The heavy drumming of the rain for a moment or two was the only sound. Briggs said, "Well, these things are still very iffy, as the President likes to say. We can't be going off half-cocked in this business, that much is certain. In any case," he turned to Kirby with an agreeable smile, "I don't think we need to detain you. Your report has been very useful. Many thanks." Gathering up his papers, Kirby said, "Will you need me again, or do I go back to Denver?"
"Don't rush off, Fred," Lawrence said.
"Right, I'll be at the Stevens." Kirby passed the morning in his hotel suite, listening to the radio bulletins and special reports on the invasion of Russia, and growing gloomier and gloomier. The incessant rain, with the sporadic lightning and thunder, reinforced his dark mood. He had not drunk before lunch in a long time, but he sent for a bottle of scotch, and had it almost a third emptied when Lawrence called in high spirits.
"Fred, you shone this morning. I thought we might manage lunch, but the committee's sending out for coffee and sandwiches and working straight on through. Maybe something has come up. Do you have a minute?"
"I'm just sitting here listening to CBS broadcast The End of the World." Lawrence laughed.
"It won't end. We'll beat the Germans to U-235, and that's the key to this war. Their industrial base is far inferior to ours, but the committee will certainly have to change its ways. The procedure is incredibly cumbersome. This business right now, for instance, intolerable. One interview at a time for secrecy, tying all of us up for days on end. We need one knowledgeable man in constant liaison with business and industry, and we need him right away."
Lawrence paused and added,
"We've just been talking about you.
Me? No thanks.
Fred, you're an engineer. You know business, and your grasp of theory is adequate. That's the desired combination, and it's rare. Unfortunately, no job in the world is more important right now, and you know that.
But ye gods, who would I work for, and report to? Not the National Bureau of Standards, for God's sake.
That point is wide open. For secrecy, you might just get a consultant post in the Navy. Captain Kelleher is full of fire to get going, which rather amuses me. Years ago, Fermi came to the Navy with this entire project outlined. They turned him away as a crackpot. The Navy turned away Enrico Fermi.
Well, Fred, will you serve?
After a pause, Kirby said, "Where would I be posted?"
"It would have to be in Washington."
Kirby was silent so long that Lawrence added, "Something wrong with going to Washington?"
"I didn't say that, but if you want those electromagnets built, that's a year away, even assuming the approach is approved and the money appropriated. This must be done now. What do you say?"
This was Lawrence in his urgent and imperious vein, which Kirby knew well. He considered Lawrence possibly the most brilliant man alive. Kirby was several years older than the Nobel Prize winner. He had given up a straight scientific career and gone into industry after getting his Ph.D., largely because of his encounters with Lawrence and a few other men much younger than himself and unreachably more brilliant. They had made him feel outclassed and deflated. To be urged now by this man to take on a task of this importance was irresistible.
"I hope to hell I'm not offered the job," he said. "If I am, I'll accept."
By the time the sun rose over San Francisco, the line between night and day had traveled halfway around the earth, and the invasion of the Soviet Union was half a day old. Masses of men had been killed, most of them Russians, and the Soviet Air Force had lost hundreds of airplanes, or perhaps more than 1,000. The disaster was already beyond precise documenting. In the officers' club at the Mare Island Navy Yard, at a window table in the sunshine, several submarine skippers were chatting about the invasion over ham and eggs. There was little dispute over the outcome. All agreed that the Soviet Union would be crushed. Some gave the Red Army as long as 6 weeks, others foresaw the end in 3 weeks or 10 days. These young professional officers were not a narrow-minded or prejudiced handful. Their view was held in the armed forces of the United States right to the top. The wretched showing of the Red Army against Finland had confirmed the judgment that communism and Stalin's bloody purges had reduced Russia to a nation of no military account. American war plans in June 1941 ignored the Soviet Union in estimating the world's strategic picture. The submariners at Mare Island, peacefully gossiping at breakfast about the spread of the Holocaust on the other side of the world, were expressing only what the service as a whole believed. The main topic of discussion was whether or not the Japanese would now strike, and if so, where. These few lieutenant commanders inclined to agree that so long as the president kept up his suicidal policy of letting them buy more and more oil and scrap iron, the Japs would probably hold off. But the consensus lasted only until Branch Hoban of the Devilfish challenged it. No skipper in the squadron had more prestige. Hoban's high standing in his class, his chilling air of competence, his sharp bridge game, his golf shooting in the 70s, his ability to hold liquor, his beautiful wife, his own magazine cover good looks, all added up to an almost suspiciously glamorous facade. But the facade was backed by performance. Under his command, the Devilfish had earned 3 E's in engineering and gunnery, and in fleet maneuvers in May, he had sneaked the Devilfish inside a destroyer screen and hypothetically sunk a battleship. He was clearly a comer, headed for flag rank. When Lieutenant Commander Hoban talked,
Others listened. Hoban argued that the world situation was like a football game, and that in Asia, the Russian-Siberian army was the player facing Japan. With his latest move, Hitler had sucked the Russian man back toward the other wing to be held as Stalin's last reserve. This was Japan's big chance. The Nips now had a clear field to run the ball from China south to Singapore, the Celebes, and Java, cleaning up all the rich European possessions. If only they moved fast enough, they could go over the line before the United States could pull itself together and interfere. He broke off, elaborating this favorite metaphor of servicemen, and left the breakfast table when he saw his new executive officer motioning to him in the doorway. Lieutenant Astor handed him a dispatch from Commander, Submarines Pacific. Devilfish overhaul canceled, exception repairs vital operational readiness. Report earliest possible date, underway, Manila.
"Well, well, back to base," Hoban grinned with a trace of high-strung eagerness. "Very well, so ComSub Pack expects the kickoff too. Let's see, today's the 22nd, huh? There's that compressor and number 4 torpedo tube that have to be buttoned up. Obviously, we don't get the new motor generator, and all the job orders will have to wait till we get alongside in Manila. But that's okay."
Holding the dispatch against the wall, he penciled in neat print, "Underway 24th 0700, and handed it to Astor.
"Send that off, operational priority."
"Can we do it, sir?"
"Make the captain of the yard an information addressee. He'll damn well get us out of here."
"Aye, aye, sir. We'll be short an officer. Ensign Bilotti's hospitalized for 2 weeks."
"Damnation, that I forgot. Well, we sail with 4 officers, then. Stand watch and watch till we get to Pearl and try to hook us a fresh ensign out of the sub-pool there."
"Captain, do you know anybody in ComSub-PAC personnel?"
"Yes, why?"
"Well enough to swipe an ensign off new construction?" To Astor's saucy grin, Hoban returned a droll grimace.
"Got someone in mind?"
"There's this ensign, a shipmate of mine off the S-45, who's just reported aboard the Tuna. It's 2 whole months away from shakedown."
"Is he a good officer?"
"Well, unfortunately he's a sack rat and goof-off."
"Then what do we want him for?"
"I can make him deliver. In a pinch, he's resourceful and courageous. His father's a captain in war plans, and his brother flies an SBD off the Enterprise."
"That doesn't sound too bad. What class is he?"
"He's a reserve." "Look, Captain," Astor exclaimed at Hoban's wry expression, "the officer pool will be full of reserves. You're not going to keep a whole wardroom of regulars, not on the Devilfish. Byron stands a good diving watch, and I know him."
"Byron?"
"His name's Byron Henry. Briny, they call him."
"Okay, maybe I'll telephone Pearl. Kind of a dirty trick to play on this Briny, though, isn't it? New construction based in Pearl is a lot better duty than going to Manila and the Devilfish."
"Tough titty." Hoban looked curiously at his executive officer. He did not yet have Astor sized up.
"Don't you like him, lady?"
Astor shrugged. "We're short a watchstander." The Pacific showed no combative specks to the westward-moving sunrise. Early sunlight slanted into the hangar deck of the Enterprise, moored to buoys in Pearl Harbor, on disemboweled airplanes, half-assembled torpedoes, and all the vast clutter of the floating machine shop that this deck was in peacetime. Sailors in greasy dungarees and officers in khakis were at work everywhere. Through the steel hollow, smelling as all carriers do of gasoline, rubber, metal, and sea air, a bosun's pipe reverberated above the workday noise, followed by a southern voice on the loudspeaker.
"Now hear this, meeting of all officers in the wardroom in 10 minutes.
Warren Henry climbed out of the cockpit of an SBD, wiping his hands on a greasy cloth. He put on his khaki cap, saying to the sailors working with him, "That's me. Wish me luck." When he arrived in the wardroom, officers in khaki shirts and black ties already filled the chairs and lined the sides. Amidships, against the forward bulkhead, stood the movie screen, and on the green baize of a nearby table, a slide projector rested. The captain, a chubby man with thick, prematurely gray hair, rose and strode before the screen as soon as he saw Warren. "Gentlemen, I guess you've all heard the news. I've been keeping track on the shortwave, and it seems clear already that Der Führer has caught Joe Stalin with his hammer and sickle down." The officers tittered formally at the captain's pleasantry. "Personally, I feel sorry for the Russian people, saddled with such lousy leadership. The few times I've encountered their Navy officers, I've found them friendly and quite professional, though somewhat odd in their ways. The question is, how does this affect the mission of the Enterprise? Now, as many of us know, Lieutenant Henry of Scouter Squadron 6 is something of a red-hot on military history. I've asked him to give us a short fill-in here, before we get on with the day's work, so that— Attention on deck!" Rear Admiral Colton appeared through a doorway, and with the noisy scrape of scores of chairs, all the officers stood up. He was a barrel-chested man with a plump, purplish face, scarred by plane crashes, a naval aviator dating back to the Langley, now Com Air Pack's chief of staff. The captain conducted him to a leather armchair hastily vacated by his exec. Lighting an enormous black cigar, the admiral motioned at the officers to take their seats. Standing before the screen, Warren started in the modest monotone of most Navy instructors, hands on hips, legs slightly apart. He made the conventional deprecatory joke about his ignorance, then went straight at the topic. "Okay. Now, naturally, our concern is the Japanese. In theory, there should be no battle problem here. We're so much stronger than Japan in military potential that any Jap move to start a war looks suicidal. So you hear civilians say we'll blow the little yellow bastards off the map in 2 weeks, and all that poppycock." Some of the young officers were smiling. Their smiles faded. Warren hooked a blue and yellow hydrographic office chart over the movie screen and took up a pointer. "Here's a chart of the Pacific. People shouldn't talk about blowing anybody off the map without a map in front of them." Warren's pointer circled the French, Dutch, and British possessions in Southeast Asia. "Oil, rubber, tin, rice. You name what Japan needs to be a leading world power, and there it sits. With what's happened to the armed forces of the European empires since 1939, it's almost up for grabs. And the first thing to notice is that it's all in the Jap backyard. We have to steam for days, far past Japan, just to get there. The territory in dispute in any Pacific war will be 10,000 miles or more from San Francisco, and at some points, only 800 miles from Tokyo. Well, so our government's been trying to keep the Japs quiet by letting them buy from us all the steel, scrap iron, and oil they want. Though, of course, the stuff goes straight into the stockpile they need to fight a war against us. Now, I have no opinion of that policy."
"I sure have," came a sarcastic, gravelly growl from the admiral.
The officers laughed and applauded. Colton went on.
"It's not fit for tender ears. Sooner or later they'll come steaming east, burning Texaco oil and shooting pieces of old Buicks at us. Some policy. Go ahead, Lieutenant. Sorry."
Quiet ensued as Warren took away the chart. A pallid slide flashed on the screen, a situation map of the Russo-Japanese War. "Okay, a little ancient history now. Here's Port Arthur," Warren pointed, "tucked far into the Yellow Sea, behind Korea. Jap backyard again. Here's where the Japs beat the Russians in 1905. Without a declaration of war, they made a sneak attack on the Tsar's navy, a night torpedo attack. The Ruskies never recovered. The Nips landed, and it besieged this key ice-free port. When Port Arthur finally fell, that was it. The Tsar accepted a negotiated peace with a primitive country 1/60th the size of his own. It was as great a victory for the Japs as the American Revolution was for us. Now, I personally think our history books don't give that war enough play. That's where modern Japanese history starts. Maybe that's where all modern history starts, because that's where the colored man for the first time took on the white man and beat him. In one corner, near the serving pantry, the white-coated steward's mates, all Filipino or Negro, were gathered. When the topic was not secret, they had the privilege of listening to officer lectures. Glances now wandered to them from all over the wardroom, in a sudden stillness. The Filipino faces were blank masks. The Negro's expressions were various and enigmatic. Some of the younger ones tartly smiled. This awkward moment caught Warren unawares. The presence of the steward's mates had been a matter of course to him, hardly noticed. He shook off the embarrassment and plowed on. Well, this was a hell of a feat, only half a century after Perry opened up the country. The Japs learned fast. They traded silk and art objects to the British for a modern steam navy. They hired the Germans to train them an army. Then they crossed to the mainland and licked Russia. But remember, Moscow was a whole continent away from Port Arthur. The only link was a railroad. Long supply lines licked the Tsar. Long supply lines licked Cornwallis, and long supply lines licked Napoleon in Russia. The further you have to go to fight, the more you thin out your strength just getting there and coming back. Incidentally, at the Naval War College, war games often start with a sneak attack by the Japs on us, right here in Pearl Harbor. That derives from the Port Arthur attack. The way the Jap mind works, why shouldn't they repeat a trick on the White Devils that once paid off so well? Well, of course, 1941 isn't 1905. We've got search planes and radar. This time, the Japs could get themselves royally clobbered. Still, the nature of this enemy is strange. You can't rule that possibility out. But always remember his objective. When the Japs took on the Tsar in 1904, they had no intention of marching to Moscow. Their objective was to grab off territory in their own backyard and hold it. That's what they did, and they still hold it. If war breaks out in the Pacific, the Japs are not going to set forth to occupy Washington, D.C., and my guess is they won't even menace Hawaii. They couldn't care less. They'll strike south for the big grab, and then they'll dare us to come on across a supply line 10,000 miles long. Through their triple chain of fortified island airfields, the Gilberts, the Marshalls, and the Marianas, and their surface and submarine fleets operating close to home under an umbrella of land-based air. So I don't exactly see us blowing them off the map in 2 weeks. Warren looked around at the more than 100 somber young faces. Peace in the Pacific once rested on a rickety three-legged stool. One leg was American naval power. The second, the European forces in Southeast Asia. And the third, the Russian land power in Siberia. The European leg of the stool got knocked out in 1940 by the Germans. Yesterday, the Germans knocked out the Russian leg. Stalin's not going into any Asian war, not now. So it's all up to us. And with two legs out of the stool, I would say peace in the Pacific has fallen on its ass. Warren had been talking along very solemnly, flourishing his pointer. The joke brought surprised chuckles. As to Captain Nugent's question, what does Hitler's move mean to us? The answer therefore comes out loud and clear. When you look at the map, Der Führer has sounded general quarters for the Enterprise. Rear Admiral Colton was first on his feet to lead the applause. Clenching the cigar in his teeth, He pumped Warren's hand. Gliding across an imaginary line that splits the Pacific Ocean from the north to the south polar caps, the sunrise acquired a new label, June 23rd. Behind that line, June 22nd had just dawned. This murky international convention, amid world chaos, still stood. For the globe still turned, as always, in the light of the sun, 90 million miles away in black space. And the tiny dwellers on the globe still had to agree, as they went about their mutual butcheries, on a way to tell the time. The daylight slipped westward, over the waters, over charming green island chains, once German colonies, all entrusted to Japan under her pledge not to fortify them. All fortified. Endeavoring to emulate the white man, Japan had studied European history in the matter of keeping such pledges. Day came to the city of Tokyo, dotted with charming parks and temples and an imperial palace, but otherwise a flat, sprawling slum of matchbox shacks and shabby Western buildings. Catching up with the white man in two generations had impoverished the Japanese. 4 years of the China incident had drained them dry. Obedient to their leaders, they were bending to their tasks, eating prison fare, building war machines by borrowed blueprints with borrowed metals under borrowed technical advisors, desperately trading silk, cameras, and toys for oil to make the machines go. 90 million of them toiled on 4 quake-ridden rocky islands full of slumbering volcanoes, an area no larger than California. Their chief natural resource was willpower. The rest of the world knew little more about them than what could be learned from Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado. They were puzzling people. Their foreign minister, a little mustached man named Matsuoka, American-educated and much-traveled in Europe, gave the impression of being a lunatic, with his voluble, self-contradictory chatter and his wild giggling, grinning, and hissing, so different from the expected deportment of the Oriental. White diplomats guessed that his strange ways must be part of the Japanese character. Only later did it turn out that the Japanese also thought he was demented. Why the militarist cabinet entrusted him with mortally serious matters at this time remains a historical mystery, like the willingness of the Germans to follow Hitler, who, in his writings and speeches, always appeared to people of other countries an obvious maniac. It is not clear just how crazy Stalin was at this time, though most historians agree he later went stark mad. In any case, the deranged Matsuoka was in charge of Japan's relations with the world when the deranged Hitler attacked the deranged Stalin. Japanese historians recount that Matsuoka obtained an urgent audience with the emperor and begged him to invade Siberia right away. But the army and navy leaders were cool to the idea. In 1939, the army had had a nasty, unpublicized tangle with Stalin's Siberian army, taking losses in the tens of thousands. They wanted to go south, where the Vichy French were impotent, the Dutch were cut off from home, and the beleaguered English could spare little force. Warren Henry's amateur analysis on the Enterprise's hangar deck had not been wrong on these main alternatives. But Matsuoka insisted that by signing the tripartite pact with Germany and Italy, Japan had pledged to help them if they were attacked, and the German invasion clearly had taken place to fend off a Russian attack. Morality therefore required Japan to invade Siberia at once. As for the non-aggression pact with Russia, which he had himself negotiated, Russia never kept pacts anyway. To attack right now was vital, before Russia collapsed, in order for the onslaught to appear honorable and not just picking up pieces. Matsuoka called this position moral diplomacy. One high-placed official is supposed to have commented quite seriously at this time that the foreign minister was insane, to which an elder statesman replied that insanity in Matsuoka would be an improvement. So much can one sift from the Japanese record. The official secret decision was to let the persimmon ripen on the tree, that is, not to attack the Soviet Union until its defeat looked like more of a sure thing. For the China War went on, an endless bog, and the Japanese leaders were not eager to take on heavy new land operations. The thrust south looked like the easier option if they had to fight. Planning for this was to proceed. Matsuoka was dismayed, and he soon fell from office. At the time of sunrise in Tokyo, the sun had already been traversing Siberia for over 3 hours, starting at Bering Strait. Before bringing a second sunrise to the battlefront, it had 8 more hours to travel, for the Soviet Union stretches halfway around the globe. Amid the invasion rumors of May and June, a bitter story had swept through Europe, crossing the frontiers between German-held and free territory. A Berlin actress, the story went, resting after lovemaking with a Wehrmacht general, persuaded him to tell her about the coming invasion of Russia. He obligingly took down an atlas of the world and began, but she soon interrupted him. "Liebchen, but what is that great big green space there, all across the map?" "Why, that, Liebchen, as I told you, is the Soviet Union." "Ach so, and where did you say Germany was?" The general showed her the narrow black blob in mid-Europe. "Liebchen," the actress said pensively, "has the Führer seen this map?" It was a good joke, but the nerve center of the Soviet Union was not in Vladivostok, at the far eastern end of the green space. The sunrise of June 23rd, passing west of the Russian capital, shone out within the hour on German columns, 25 miles advanced toward Minsk and Moscow in one day, through the massed forces of the Red Army and its heaviest border defenses. Chapter 46. Purple lightning cracked down the black sky, forking behind the Washington Monument in jagged streams. July on the Potomac was going out, as usual, in choking heat and wild thunderstorms. "There goes my walk home," Victor Henry said. Through the open window, a tongue of cool air licked into the stifling, humid office, scattering heavy raindrops on the wall charts. It began to pour in the street, a thick, hissing shower.
"Maybe it'll break the heat wave," Julius said.
Julius was a chief yeoman who had worked with him in the Bureau of Ordnance, a fat, placid man of 50, with a remarkable head for statistics. "No such luck. The steam will be denser, that's all." Pug looked at his watch. "Hey, it's after 6. Ring my house, will you? Tell the cook dinner at 7.
"Aye, aye, sir."
Tightening his tie and slipping into a seersucker jacket, Pug scooped up papers from the desk. "I want to study these figures some more. They're kind of incredible, Julius." With a shrug and wave of both hands, Julius said,
"They're as good as the premises you gave me to work from."
"Jehoshaphat, if it comes to that many landing craft for the two oceans, how can we build anything else for the next 3 years?" Julius gave him the slightly superior smile of an underling who, on a narrow topic, knows more than the boss.
"We produce 60 million tons of steel a year, sir, but making all those hair dryers and refrigerators and 40 different models of cars, too, that's the problem."
Pug dove through the rain to a taxicab that drew up at the Navy building. A very tall man got out, pulling a soft hat low on his head.
"All yours."
"Why, hello there."
"Well, hi."
Pug pulled out his wallet and gave the taxi driver a bill, saying, "Wait, please."
"How long have you been in Washington, Kirby?"
"About a month."
"Come home with me for a drink. Better yet, join me for dinner."
"Thanks, but I don't think I can."
"I'm alone," said Victor Henry.
Kirby hesitated.
"Where's your wife?"
spending my money in New York. She saw off our daughter-in-law and grandson on a plane to Hawaii. Now she's shopping for furniture and stuff. We bought a house.
Oh, did she get the one on Foxhall Road?
That's the one. How do you know about it?
Well, I ran into Rhoda when she was house hunting. You were out at sea, I guess. We had lunch, and she showed me the place. I was all for it.
Got much to do? Pug insisted. I'll wait for you.
As a matter of fact, Kirby said abruptly, I only have to pick up some papers. Let me dash in here for a minute. I'll be glad to have that drink with you.
Soon they sat together in the cab, moving slowly in the clogged rush-hour traffic of Constitution Avenue, in torrents of rain.
What are you doing in this dismal town? Pug said.
Oh, this and that.
You know what? Grinned Pug, stressing you for uranium.
Kirby glanced at the bald, round head and red ears of the driver.
Driver, turn on your radio, Pug said. Let's catch the news.
But the driver could only get jazz, buzzing with static.
I don't know what you hope to hear, Kirby said, except that the Germans are another 50 miles nearer Moscow.
Our department's getting edgy about the Japs.
I can't figure out the president's order, Kirby said. Neither can the papers, it seems.
Okay, he froze their credits. Does it or doesn't it cut off their oil?
Sure it does. They can't pay.
Doesn't that force them to go to war?
Maybe. The president had to do something about this Vichy deal that puts Jap airfields and armies in Indochina. Saigon's a mighty handy jump-off point for Malaya and Java, and Australia, for that matter.
Kirby deliberately packed his pipe.
How is Rhoda?
Snappish about various foul-ups in the new house. Otherwise, fine.
Through puffs of blue smoke, the scientist said,
What do we actually want of the Japs now?
To cease their aggression. Back up out of Indochina. Get off the Chinese mainland. Call off that Manchukuo farce and free Manchuria.
In other words, said Kirby, give up all hope of becoming a major power and accept a military defeat, which nobody's inflicted on them.
We can lick them at sea.
Do we have an army to drive them out of Asia?
No.
Then don't we have our gall ordering them out?
Pug looked at Kirby under thick eyebrows, his head down on his chest. The humidity was giving him a headache, and he was very tired.
Look, militarist fanatics have taken charge there, Kirby. You know that. Slant-eyed samurais with industrial armaments. If they ever break loose and win Southeast Asia, you'll have a yellow Germany in the Pacific, with unlimited manpower and most of the oil and rubber in the world. We have to maneuver while we can, and fight if we must. The president's freezing order is a maneuver. Maybe he'll work out some deal with them.
Appeasement, Kirby said.
Exactly, appeasement. We've been appeasing them right along with the oil shipments. So far they haven't attacked south, and they haven't hit Russia in the back. I think the president's just feeling his way, day by day and week by week.
Why doesn't he declare war on Germany? Kirby said. Why this interminable pussyfooting about convoys? Once Russia collapses, the last chance to stop Hitler will be gone.
I can tell you why Roosevelt doesn't declare war on Germany, mister,
spoke up the taxi driver in a rough, good-humored southern voice, not looking around.
Oh, why? Said Kirby.
Because he'd be impeached if he tried, that's why, mister. He knows goddamn well that the American people aren't going to war to save the Jews.
He glanced over his shoulder. Blue eyes twinkled in a friendly, fat face, smiling jovially.
I have no prejudices. I'm not prejudiced against the Jews, but I'm not prejudiced for them, either. Not enough to send American boys to die for them. That's not unreasonable, is it?
Maybe you'd better look where you're driving, said Pug.
The cavvy subsided.
"It's a nice spot," Kirby said.
They were on the back porch, and Pug was pouring martinis. The house stood on a little knoll, topping a smooth lawn and a ravine of wild woods. A fresh breeze, smelling of wet leaves and earth, cooled the porch.
"Rhoda likes it."
They drank in silence.
"How about that cabbie?" said Kirby.
"Well, he said it straight out. It's been said on the Senate floor often, in double talk."
Kirby emptied his glass, and Pug at once refilled it.
"Thanks, Pug. I'm having unusual feelings these days. I'm starting to suspect that the human race as we know it may not make it through the Industrial Revolution."
"I've had a bad day myself," Pug said, as the scientist lit his pipe.
"No," Kirby said, slowly waving out the thick wooden match. "Let me try to put this into words. It's occurred to me that our human values, our ideas of right and wrong, good and bad, evolved in simpler times, before there were machines. Possibly the Germans and the Japanese are really adapting better to the new environment. Their successes suggest that. Also, the way their opponents keep stumbling and crumbling. We may be having a Darwinian change in society. Authoritarian rule may be best suited to urban machine life. Armed bosses indifferent to mercy or probity, keeping order by terror, and ready to lie and kill as routine policy. After all, most of the machines aren't 100 years old. The airplane isn't 40 years old. And democracy is still a fragile experiment."
Kirby paused to drain his glass.
"You called the Japanese industrial samurais. That rang a bell. They've starved themselves, stripped their country to build or buy machines. And they've jumped out of nowhere to center stage of history.
The Nazi or samurai idea may just make more sense in a changed world, Pug."
"Is this merely martini talk? And is there any left in that jug?"
"There's plenty," said Pug, pouring. "And more where it came from. I'm feeling better by the minute. It's nice on this porch."
"It's marvelous," said Palmer Kirby.
"Why don't you stay for dinner?" Pug said. "What else do you have to do?"
"I don't like to impose on you. I'm having chops, potatoes, and a salad. It's just putting on a couple more chops. Let me tell the cook."
"All right, Pug. Thanks. I've done a lot of eating alone lately."
"Be back in a minute," said Victor Henry, taking the jug. He brought it back, full and tinkling.
"I put off dinner," he said. "Give us a chance to relax."
"Suits me," said Kirby. "Though from the mood I'm in and the size of that jug, you may have to lead me to the dining room."
"It's not far," Pug said, "and the furniture has few sharp edges."
Kirby laughed.
"You know, about the first thing your very sweet wife Rhoda said to me was that I drank too much. At the dinner she gave me in Berlin, you remember, when you had to fly back to see the president? I was in a bad mood, and I did swill a lot of wine fast. She brought me up short."
"That was rude. The amount a man drinks is his own business," said Pug. "Not to mention that on occasion my proud beauty has sort of a hollow leg herself."
"Say, you mix a hell of a good martini, Pug."
"Kirby, what you were saying before, you know, is only this wave of the future stuff that the Lindberghs have been peddling."
"Well, Lindy's the type of the new man, isn't he? Flying an ocean by himself in a single-motor plane? He pointed the way to much that's happened since."
"He's not a liar and murderer."
"Only the bosses need be, Henry. The rest, including the scientific and mechanical geniuses, like Lindy, and the wheel horses, like me, merely have to obey. That's obviously what's been happening in Germany."
"I'll tell you, Kirby," Pug said, swirling his glass and feeling very profound. "There's nothing new about such leaders. Napoleon was one. He had his propaganda line, too, that weakened the foe before he fired a shot. Why, he was bringing liberty, equality, fraternity to all Europeans. So he laid the continent waste and made it run with blood for a dozen years or so, until they got wise to him and caught him and marooned him on a rock. You think that'll happen to Hitler? I hope so. There's a difference. Napoleon had no machines. If he had had airplanes, telephones, tanks, trucks, machine guns, the whole industrial apparatus, don't you think he might have clamped a lasting tyranny on Europe? I'm not sure. I happen to have a low opinion of Napoleon. Napoleon sold Jefferson nearly 1 million square miles of prime land, you know, our whole Middle West, from Louisiana to the Rockies and the Canadian border, for $15 million. $15 million. Figured out to 4 cents an acre for real estate like Iowa and Nebraska and Minnesota, with all that iron ore. Colorado, with its gold and silver. Oklahoma, with its oil. I don't see how anybody, even a Frenchman, can figure Napoleon as a genius. He was a bloodthirsty ass. If he'd sent just one of his smaller armies over here to protect that territory, just a couple of divisions to hold the Louisiana Territory, instead of wandering around Europe slaughtering and looting, and a few thousand Frenchmen to colonize the land, there's little doubt that France would be the world's greatest power today, instead of what she is, a raped old bag. I can't say that has occurred to me before, Kirby said, smiling at the phrase. It's probably fallacious.
What's happening with uranium? Victor Henry said.
Kirby's smile turned wary. Is that why you're plying me with martinis?
If martinis can loosen you up about uranium, Kirby, let it happen first with an officer in war plans, and thereafter don't drink martinis.
Doesn't war plans have any information?
No, it's still Jules Verne talk to us.
Unfortunately, it's more than that.
The rain was starting again, with a whistle of wind, a rumble of thunder, and a whoosh of raindrops through the porch screen. Pug dropped a canvas flap on the windward side, fastening it down as Kirby talked.
The best present judgment, Pug, is that the bomb can be built. It might take, with an all-out effort, 2 years or 50 years. Those are the brackets. But we're not making an all-out effort. We're making a good effort on the theory end. That's all. Tremendous brains are at work, some of them driven from Europe by the Germans, for which we owe them cordial thanks. The big question is, how far ahead are the Germans by now? We aren't even started. There's no money available and no plan. Making uranium bombs will go in several stages, and some of us fear that the Germans have cracked stage one, which is to get enough of the isotope to start a controlled chain reaction.
What kind of weapon are we talking about here? Said Pug. How powerful and explosive?
Again, the answer is X. The power may be too much altogether. That is, the bomb may blow itself apart before it can really work. In theory, one bomb might level New York City, or even an area like Rhode Island. You're dealing here with very large unknowns. There's talk that it could start a process that could blow up the Earth. The best men don't take that too seriously. I frankly don't know enough to be sure.
You're talking about a pretty good bomb, said Victor Henry.
Hello?
Rhoda Henry's voice rang through the spacious house, and they heard heels clicking on the parquet floor.
Surprise! Anybody home? I'm drenched. I'm a drowned rat.
Hi, I'm out here, Pug called. And we've got company.
We have?
Hello, Rhoda, said Kirby, standing.
Oh, my God!
She froze in the doorway, staring. Rhoda's purple hat dripped. She carried a sodden paper bundle, and her flowered silk dress clung wetly to her shoulders and bosom. Her face glistened with rain. Her eye makeup was blurred, her lipstick blotchy on pale lips. Wet strands of hair hung down her forehead and neck. Pug said, "You finished up sort of fast in New York, didn't you? I asked Fred Kirby in for a drink because we happened—" Rhoda vanished. Her scampering footsteps dwindled into the house and up a staircase.
"Dad, what a place! It's a mansion!"
Madeline walked through the doorway, as wet as her mother, shaking rain from her hair and laughing.
"Well, Maddie, you too."
"Look at me. Christ, did we catch it. No cabs in sight, and hello, Dr. Kirby."
"You'll both get the flu," Pug Henry said.
"If somebody gave me a martini," said Madeline, eyeing the jug, "I might fight the infection off."
She explained, as her father poured the drink, that Hugh Cleveland had business at the War Department next morning. Rhoda had decided to come back to Washington with them. The girl took a quick, practiced pull at the cocktail.
"Where's your luggage?" Pug said. "Go put on dry clothes."
"I dropped my stuff at the Willard, Dad."
"What? Why? Here's a whole big house at your disposal."
"Yes, I came to have a look at it. Then I'll go back to the hotel and change."
"But why the devil are you staying at the hotel?"
"Oh, it's simpler."
She glanced at her watch.
"Christ, almost 7 o'clock.
Pug wrinkled his nose at his daughter, not caring much for her brassiness. But she looked pretty, despite her wet hair and wrinkled pink linen suit. Rhoda's fear that Madeline would turn plain at 21 was proving flat wrong.
"What's the rush?"
"We're having dinner with a big army wheel, Dad, to try to sell him on a new program idea. Hugh visits a different military installation every week. We put on amateurs from the service and do a tour of the base, and a pitch about preparedness. I suggested the idea, even the name, the Happy Hour. The network is wild about it."
She looked at the two middle-aged men, her eyes very bright, and held out her glass.
"Can I have a little more? I'll own stock in this thing if it goes through. Imagine, I actually will. Hugh Cleveland's going to form a corporation and give me some stock. He promised me. How about that? Maybe I'll be rich. Well, Dad?"
She added with an arch giggle,
"You look kind of sour."
"To begin with," Pug said, "come September we may not have an army. Don't you read the papers?"
Madeline's face fell. "You mean about the draft?"
"Yes. Right now it's 50-50 or worse that Congress won't vote for renewal."
"But that's insane. Why, by September, Hitler will probably have beaten Russia. How far is he from Moscow now? 100 miles or something?"
"I'm not saying the politicians make sense. I'm telling you the fact."
"Christ, that would blow the Happy Hour sky high, wouldn't it? Oh, well, we'll see."
She stood, shaking out her skirt.
"Oh, I have rain trickling around inside in odd little places. I'll take a fast gander at the house, then I'll tool off."
"I'll show you around," Pug said. "How about it, Kirby? Wanna join the tour?"
"I guess I'll leave," said Kirby. "Rhoda's back, and I don't want to intrude, and besides, I have a lot of—"
"You sit right down,"
Victor Henry said, pushing Palmer Kirby into a wicker armchair.
"Houses bore me, too. Have one more shorty, and I'll be joining you."
"I've had plenty," Kirby said, reaching for the jug.
Madeline went from room to room with her father, exclaiming with pleasure at what she saw.
"Christ, look at the moldings in this dining room! Oh, Christ, what a stunning fireplace! Christ, look at the size of these closets!"
"Say, I'm no prude," Pug remarked at last, "but what's this Christ, Christ business? You sound like a deckhand."
Rhoda called from her dressing room.
"That's right, Pug, tell her.
I've never heard anything like it. You get more Christs from her in 5 minutes than in a church sermon an hour long. It's so vulgar.
Madeline said,
Sorry, it's a habit I've caught from Hugh.
Oh, Pug,
Rhoda's voice again, loudly casual.
Where did you dig up Palmer Kirby? Did he telephone?
Just ran into him. He's staying for dinner. Is that all right?
Why not? Madeline, you're not really staying at the Willard, are you? It looks so peculiar, dear. Please go and bring your bags home. Never mind, Mother. Bye-bye.
Pug said, walking down the stairs with her, We bought a big place just so you kids could stay here when you're in town. She put a hand lightly on his arm and smiled. The condescension embarrassed him.
Really, Dad, I know what I'm doing. We'll be up very late with the writers tonight.
This fellow, Cleveland, said Victor Henry with difficulty, is he okay? Her secure, womanly smile broadened.
Daddy, if there were any hanky-panky going on, I'd be a lot sneakier, wouldn't I? Honestly, give me some credit.
Well, you're grown up, I know that. It just came on kind of fast.
Everything's fine. I'm having the time of my life, and one day you'll be real proud of me.
I'll call a cab for you, Pug muttered, but as he reached for the telephone in the marble-floored hallway, it rang. Hello? Yes, speaking. Yes, Admiral. Madeline saw her father's face settle into tough, alert lines. Aye, aye, sir. Yes, will do. Goodbye, sir. Pug dialed Rhoda's room on the intercom line. Are you almost dressed?
5 minutes, why?
I'll tell you when you come down.
He called for a taxicab.
Madeline was used to asking no questions when Victor Henry's face took on that look, and he spoke in those tones. They returned to the porch, where Kirby lolled in the wicker armchair, smoking his pipe. Rhoda appeared almost at once in a swishy green dress, her hair smartly combed and curled, her face made up as for a dance.
"Well, quick change artistry," Pug said.
"I hope so. When I got here, I looked like the witch in Snow White."
"Rhoda, I just got a call from Admiral King. He's at the department. I'll ride downtown with Madeline. You go ahead and give Fred his dinner. Maybe I'll get back in time for coffee or something. Anyway, I'll call you when I know what it's all about."
The taxi honked outside. Kirby offered to leave, too. Victor Henry wouldn't hear of it. He liked the scientist. He had invited him home partly for company, partly to pump him about uranium. Pug Henry no more imagined anything between this man and Rhoda than he suspected his wife of cannibalism. He prevailed on Kirby to stay and left with his daughter. When the outside door closed, Rhoda said brightly,
"Well, how long has it been, Palmer? An age."
Kirby sat forward, hands on his knees. "Pug doesn't know he's put you in a spot. I'll be going." Rhoda sat composed, legs crossed, arms folded, head atilt.
"You'll waste some good double lamb chops. Can't you smell them? Dinner's about ready."
"Rhoda, I believe you don't feel in the least awkward."
"Oh, Palmer, I take things as they come. I'm very glad to see you, actually. What brings you to Washington, anyway?"
"A defense job, about which I can tell you nothing except that it's going very badly."
"You mean you're living here?"
"I have an apartment in the Wardman Park."
"Well, well. What about your factory?"
"I have excellent managers and foremen. I fly to Denver every 2 weeks or so. I just got back." With a sarcastic, one-sided grin, he added, "It's disturbing how well things go on without me."
"And how is that house of yours?"
"Fine. I didn't sell it, and now I won't."
"Oh, and now here you are. Funny."
"Funny isn't the word I would choose." Rhoda dropped her voice to a soft, intimate note.
"Was my letter so very upsetting?"
"It was the worst blow I've had since my wife died." Rhoda blinked at his rough tone and sighed. I'm sorry. She sat clasping and unclasping her fingers in her lap. Then she tossed her head. I'm trying to think how to tell this so I don't come out a flibbertigibbet, but to hell with that. I sat next to the president at that White House dinner. He was nice to me. He liked me. He said wonderful things about Pug, about his future career. A divorced man is very handicapped in the service, especially when he's in sight of flag rank. I'm very aware of that. I've seen how it works. And, well, so I did what I did. I've slept badly ever since Palmer, and I've been an awful crab. But I've stuck to him, and I don't intend to apologize.
Dinner, Miss Henry?
A gray-haired colored woman in a white smock appeared in the doorway, looking sad and reproachful.
Oh, dear! Oh, yes. What time is it, Barbara?
It's 8:30 now, Miss Henry.
That's awful. I never intended for you to remain this late. Palmer, you're staying, of course. Just put it on the table, will you, Barbara? Then you can go.
By the time Rhoda Henry and Palmer Kirby had finished off the thick chops, a salad, and a bottle of wine, the tension between them was gone, and he was laughing at her droll stories of troubles with the new house. She was laughing, too, though, as she said, at the time, the mishaps had put her in wild rages.
"What would you say to another glass of St. Julian with the cheese, Palmer?"
"Rhoda, if he comes home and finds us cracking a second bottle, those eyebrows will go way up, so."
"Oh, pshaw!" She began clearing dishes. "Many's the second bottle he and I have cracked. And third ones on occasion."
She paused, holding a stack of dishes.
"I can't tell you how good I feel. This couldn't possibly have been planned, but there's a great weight off my mind."
Rhoda brought the coffee and the second bottle out to the back porch. The rain was over. Beyond the dim trees, in July twilight fading into darkness, a few stars showed.
"Oh, isn't this pleasant?" she said. "I think this porch is the reason I wanted the place. It makes me think of the house we had in Berlin."
"This is like a Berlin summer evening," Kirby said. "The light that lingers on, the fresh smell of rained-on trees." She said,
"You remember?"
"I have an excellent memory, a little too good." "I have a very handy one, Palmer. It tends to remember the good and forget the bad."
"That is a female memory."
Dr. Kirby gulped his wine with an abrupt motion. "Now let me ask you something, Rhoda. This may really sound offensive, but we may never talk like this again. I've had a lot to drink, much too much, no doubt. Your letter was a bad shock. I've thought and thought about this thing ever since. You told me that until I came along, there had been no one else. I believed you. I still do. But I have a question to ask you. How come?" After a marked silence, broken only by the chirping of birds, he said, "I've made you angry."
"No."
Rhoda's voice was throaty and calm.
"Of course I know the answer you want, that you were irresistible, and there'd never been anyone remotely like you. That's true enough. Still, I've had plenty of chances, dear. And I don't just mean drunken passes at the officers' club. There have been times. But to be absolutely honest, these men have all been naval officers like Pug. That's the circle I move in. Not one has measured up to him, or even come very close."
She was silent for a space.
"Don't take this wrong. I'm not blaming Pug for what happened this time. That would be too low. But he does shut me out so much. And from the moment the war started, that got much worse. Pug's a fanatic, you know. Not about religion or politics. About getting things done."
"That's an American trait," said Palmer Kirby. "I'm the same kind of fanatic."
"Ah, but in Berlin, whether you knew it or not, you were courting me. When Pug courted me, I fell in love with him, too."
She uttered a low chuckle and added,
Let me say one thing more. Though you, of all people, might give me the horse laugh, I'm a good woman. At least I think I am. So with one thing and another, there's been no one else, nor will there be. I'm a quiet grandma now. That's that.
They did not speak for a long time. In the darkness, they were two shadowy shapes, visible only by the dim reflection of unseen street lamps on the leaves.
"Pugs never called," said Rhoda quietly.
The shape of Kirby emerged from the wicker chair, looming tall. "I'll go now. The dinner was a success. I feel remarkably better. Thanks," she said.
"Will I see you again?"
"Washington's a pretty small town. Look at the way I bumped into Pug."
"Can you find your way out, dear?"
"Certainly."
"I don't mean to be rude, but to be frank, at the moment, my eyes are messy."
Palmer Kirby came to her, bowed over her hand, and kissed it. She put her other hand over his and gave it a soft, lingering pressure.
"My," she said, "so continental, and very sweet.
Straight through the living room, darling, and turn left to the front door." Chapter 47. A week later, Victor Henry lay in the upper bunk of an officer's cabin in the heavy cruiser Tuscaloosa, above a gently snoring colonel of the Army War Plans Division, a hand on his shoulder and a whisper,
"Captain Henry?"
brought him awake. In the red glow from the corridor, he saw a sailor offering a dispatch board. Pug switched on his dim bunk light. "Desire Captain Victor Henry transfer with all gear to Augusta prior to 0500 today for forthcoming exercise. King."
"What time is it?"
Pug muttered, scribbling his initials on the flimsy sheet.
0430, and the OOD says the captain's gig is standing by for you, sir."
Pug tried to pack quietly, but a squeaky metal drawer woke the colonel.
"Hey, skipper, leaving me? Where are you off to?"
"The Augusta."
"What?"
The colonel yawned and snuggled under his blanket. Even in midsummer, the morning air was cool in Nantucket Bay.
"I thought that boat's only for big brass and the president."
"I guess the admiral decided he needs another typist."
"Would that be Admiral King, the one who shaves with a blowtorch?"
Henry laughed politely.
"Yes, that's the one."
"Well, good luck."
A brisk wind was tumbling and scattering the fog in the twilit anchorage, and the choppy water tossed the slow-moving gig so that the bell clanged randomly, and Henry had to brace himself on the dank leather seat. After a dull, rocky ride, the Augusta loomed ahead through the mist, a long, dark, unlit shape. The cruiser was not even showing anchor lights, a serious and strange peacetime violation. In the breaking fog, the president's yacht and the dunes of Martha's Vineyard were barely visible. As Captain Henry mounted the cruiser's ladder, a faint pink glow was appearing in the east. The cleanliness of the old vessel, the fresh, smooth paint, the pale gleam of bright work, the tense, quiet gait of sailors in spotless uniforms marked it as King's flagship. Peculiar long ramps on the decks and freshly welded handrails were obvious special fittings for the crippled president. Admiral King, in starchy whites, lean legs crossed, sat high in his bridge chair, querying the captain of the Augusta about arrangements for Roosevelt. He took no notice whatever of Henry's arrival. The captain, a classmate of Pug, was answering up like a midshipman at an examination. When King dismissed him, he ventured a subdued, "Hi, Pug," before leaving his bridge.
"Henry, the president will want a word with you when he comes aboard."
Fitting a cigarette into a black filter holder, King turned cold eyes on Pug.
"I just learned that, hence this transfer.
We'll be underway before you can get back to the Tuscaloosa. I trust you're prepared with any reports or information he may desire.
I have my work papers here, Admiral. Pug touched the dispatch case, which, in the transit between cruisers, had not left his hand.
King, with chin high, looked down at Victor Henry through half-closed eyes, puffing at the cigarette.
As I told you last week, the President asked to have you along on this exercise. He didn't mention that he wanted you at his beck and call, however. Are you by any chance a distant relative or an old family friend of Mr. Roosevelt?
No, Admiral.
Well, you might remember, when the occasion offers, that you work for the United States Navy.
Aye, aye, sir. Virtually nobody saw the crippled man hoisted aboard. The ship's company in dress whites was mustered on the long forecastle at attention under the main battery guns. No band played, no guns saluted. The yacht Potomac came along the port side, out of sight of Martha's Vineyard. Sharp commands rang out. A bosun's pipe squealed, the Potomac churned away, and the President appeared in his wheelchair, pushed by a Navy captain, with an impressive following of civilians, admirals, and army generals. As on a theatrical cue, the sun at that moment came out, and sunlight shafted down the decks, illuminating the grinning, waving President. The white suit and floppy white hat, the high-spirited gestures, the cigarette holder cocked upward in the massive, bespectacled face were almost too Rooseveltian to be real. An actor would have come on so, and Pug thought FDR actually was putting on a little show for the crew, perhaps responding to the burst of sunshine. The wheelchair and its entourage passed across the forecastle and went out of sight. At once the two cruisers weighed anchor and steamed out to sea, with a destroyer division screening ahead of them. The morning sun disappeared behind the clouds. In dreary gray North Atlantic weather, the formation plunged northeast at 22 knots, cutting across main ship lanes. Victor Henry walked the main deck for hours, relishing the sea wind, the tall black waves, and the slow roll of iron plates under his feet. No summons came from the President. That scarcely surprised him. His chief in the War Plans Division was aboard the Tuscaloosa. They had intended to do a lot of work en route. Now, when the two cruisers reached the rendezvous, they would need an all-night conference. The separation was probably pointless, but the President's whim had to be endured. He was finishing bacon and eggs next morning in the flag mess when a steward's mate handed him a sealed note on yellow scratch paper.
"If you're not standing watch, old man, you might look in about 10 or so. The skipper."
He folded the note carefully away in his pocket. Pug was preserving all these communications, trivial or not, for his grandchildren. At the stroke of 10, he went to flag quarters. A rugged, frozen-eyed Marine came to robot attention outside the President's suite.
"Hello there, Pug. Just in time for the news."
Roosevelt sat alone in an armchair at a green, baize-covered table, on which a small portable radio was gabbling a commercial. Dark fatigue pockets under Roosevelt's eyes showed through the pince-nez glasses, but the open shirt collar outside an old gray sweater gave him a relaxed look. He had cut himself shaving. A gash, clotted with blood, marred the big chin. His color was good, and he was snuffing with relish the wind that blew in through a scoop and mussed his thin gray hair. He shook his head sadly at a Moscow admission that the Germans had driven far past Smolensk. Then the announcer said that President Roosevelt's whereabouts were no longer a secret, and he perked up. FDR was vacationing aboard the Potomac, the announcer went on. Reporters had seen him on the afterdeck of the yacht at 8 o'clock last evening, passing through the Cape Cod Canal. Roosevelt's eyes darted cunningly at Captain Henry. his smile curved up, self-satisfied and wise.
"Ha, ha! And here I was, at 8 o'clock, out on the high seas. How do you suppose I worked that one, Pug?"
"Pretty good deception, sir. Somebody in disguise on the yacht?"
"Darn right. Tom Wilson, the engineer. We got him a white suit and white hat. Well, that's just grand. It worked."
He tuned down another commercial.
"We didn't want U-boats outgunning for Churchill and me. But I admit I get a kick out of giving the press the slip, Pug. They do make my life a misery."
Roosevelt was searching through piles of paper on the desk.
"Ah, here we are. Look this over, old fellow."
The typewritten document was headed, "For the President, Top Secret, 2 copies only. Turning up the radio again, the president slumped in his chair, and the mobile face went weary and grave as the announcer described a newspaper poll of the House of Representatives on the extension of the draft, predicting defeat of the bill by 6 to 8 votes.
"That is wrong,"
the president interjected, his heavy black-ringed eyes on the radio, as though arguing with the announcer. In the next item, the German propaganda ministry ridiculed an accusation by world Jewish leaders of massacres of Jews taking place in German-held parts of the Soviet Union. The Jews were spreading Allied atrocity propaganda, the ministry said, and the Red Cross was free to come in at any time to verify the facts.
"There's another lie,"
the president said, turning off the radio with a disgusted gesture.
"Those Nazis are the most outrageous liars, really. The Red Cross can't get in there at all. I think, and I certainly hope, those stories are terribly exaggerated. Our intelligence says they are. Still, where there's smoke..."
He took off his pince-nez and rubbed his eyes hard with thumb and forefinger.
"Pug, did your daughter-in-law ever get home with her uncle?"
"I understand they're on their way, sir."
"Good, very good."
Roosevelt puffed out a long breath.
"Quite a lad, that submariner of yours."
"A presumptuous pup, I'm afraid."
Victor Henry was trying to read the document, which was explosive, while chatting with Roosevelt. It was hard because the pages were full of figures.
"I also have a son who's an ensign, Pug. He's aboard, and I want you to meet him."
"My pleasure, sir."
Roosevelt lit a cigarette, coughing.
"I received a copy of that Jewish statement. A delegation of some old good friends brought it to me. The way the Jews stick together is remarkable, Pug. But what's one to do? Scolding the Germans is so humiliating and so futile. I've exhausted that line long ago. We've tried to get around the immigration laws with this device and that, and we've had some luck, actually. But when I've got a Congress that's ready to disband the army, can you imagine my going to them with a bill to admit more Jews? I think we'll beat them on the draft, but it'll be close at best."
While he was saying this, Franklin Roosevelt cleared a space on the table, took up 2 decks of cards, and meticulously laid out a complex solitaire game. He moved the cards around in silence for a while, then said in a new cheerful tone, as the ship took a long roll,
"By George, Pug, doesn't it feel wonderful to be at sea again?"
"It sure does, Mr. President."
"Many's the time I've sailed in these waters. I could navigate this ship for them, honor bright."
He observed Pug turning over the last page.
"Well, what do you think?"
"This is something for my chief, Mr. President."
"Yes, but Kelly Turner's over on the Tuscaloosa. Anyway, another squabble between the service heads is just what I don't want."
The president smiled at him with flattering warmth.
"Pug, you have a feeling for facts, and when you talk, I understand you. Those are 2 uncommon virtues. So, let's have it. Take your time."
"Yes, Mr. President."
Pug flipped through the document again, making quick notes on a pad. The president, chain lighting a cigarette, carefully put down card on card. Nothing in the document surprised Henry. He had heard it all before, in arguments with Army war planners. But here the Army was taking its case to the president, either through Marshall or by some devious route which the president, in his usual fashion, kept open. The document was a scorcher indeed. If it leaked to isolationist senators, it might well end Lend-Lease, kill Selective Service, and even start an impeachment drive. Hence he was taken aback to see that it existed at all. Roosevelt had called for the preparation of a victory program, a fresh start to unlock the paralysis of Lend-Lease and war production. Half a dozen agencies had tangled themselves and the big industries into impotence. The Army and Navy Munitions Board, the War Resources Board, the Office of Emergency Management, the National Defense Advisory Commission, the Office of Production Management. Their heads were jockeying for presidential favor. All Washington was bewildered by the flood of new initials. Shortages and bottlenecks were mounting, and actual munitions were being produced in a feeble trickle. To break this up, Roosevelt had ordered the armed forces to list everything they needed to win a global war and to work out new priorities from this master list. For weeks, planners like Victor Henry had been calculating possible American invasions of France, Africa, Germany, Italy, China, and Honshu, airstrikes against industrial cities, and joint operations with the British and even the Russians. The Army and the Navy, not particularly trusting each other, were hardly communicating about the program. Each had prepared a draft, and each had, of course, called for the greatest possible share of manpower and industrial output. They had been at the greatest pains to keep the victory program secret and the papers few. The document, now in Victor Henry's hands, was a sharp critique by the Army of the Navy's demands. "How about some orange juice?" the president said, as a steward entered with a pitcher on a tray. "Wouldn't you like that? Felipe squeezes it fresh. He's gotten hold of some glorious oranges."
"Thank you, sir." Pug sipped at a glass of foaming juice. "This thing needs a paper just as long in reply, Mr. President. Essentially, the Navy and the Army are just using two different crystal balls. That's inevitable. The Army's the big service, and it's ultimately responsible for the security of the United States. No argument there. They figure they may have to fight the Axis single-handed after Russia and England fold. That's why they demand so much. They arrive at the army of 9 million men by working backward from the total manpower of the United States. It's the biggest force our country can field."
"And we may well need it," said the president.
"Yes, sir. It's mainly on Lend-Lease that we see the thing differently. The army says we want to give away too many arms and machines, which the Germans may capture and use against us. But our contention is that even if the Soviet Union does go down soon, and the British too, a hell of a lot of Germans will have to die first to lick them. And every German who dies is one less German who'll be shooting at us one day."
"I agree," the president said, very flatly.
"Well then, Mr. President, shouldn't we, at any cost, strengthen these people who are killing Germans right now? We can rebuild and replace lost materiel pretty fast, but it takes 20 years to raise a live Boche to replace a dead one."
The president observed with a slight grin,
"Well said. But Lend-Lease isn't the only bone of contention here. I noticed the Navy wants a pretty hefty share of our total steel production."
"Mr. President."
Pug leaned forward, elbows on knees, hands outstretched, talking as forcefully as he could.
"Hitler didn't beat England last year because he couldn't land the strongest army in the world on a coast a few miles away.
He had all the ships he needed to carry them across, but he couldn't dock them on the other side. Assault from the sea is a tough battle problem, Mr. President. They don't come much tougher. It's easy to put your men ashore one place or another, but then how do you keep the defenders from wiping you out? Your men are stranded. The defenders have all the mobility, the numerical superiority, and the firepower. They can concentrate and crush you. As Pug talked, the president was nodding, cigarette holder drooping between his teeth, eyes piercingly attentive. Well, sir, the answer is special craft that can hit an open beach in large numbers. You throw a large force ashore and keep it supplied and reinforced until it captures a harbor. Then you can pile in with your regular transports, your luxury liners too, if you've got 'em, and your invasion's on. But those landing craft, you need swarms of them, sir, of many different designs. This analysis has been assigned to me. It looks as though we're going to have to manufacture something like 100,000, all told. 100,000? The president tossed his big head. Why, all the shipyards in the United States couldn't do that in 10 years, Pug, even if they stopped doing everything else. You're talking sheer nonsense. Everybody exaggerates his little specialty. But Roosevelt was smiling in an excited way, and his eyes were lighting up. He spoke of landing boats the Navy had used in the last war, when he was assistant secretary, and of the disastrous British landing at Gallipoli. Victor Henry took from his briefcase pictures of German invasion.